Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're fresh off our trip to Slow Food Nations in Denver, a festival that brought together advocates to discuss the future of food. And this week, we're bringing you a special episode inspired by the new Equity, Inclusion, and Justice Manifesto released by Slow Food USA.
If we're going to solve food security, we need to say these people have a right to good, healthful food. But we have to do that in a way that kind of insulates this system from the vagaries of the market.
Because when you're at a table with somebody, you recognize their humanity. And when somebody cooks for you and serves you food, in a way they're saying they care about your survival.
How can we put things into our own hands and have the people of Puerto Rico gain real access to healthy local foods?
Listen to Meat and Three this week for our highlights from Slow Food Nations, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi umami in izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guests today are David and Joshua Fukei, the two brothers who opened an authentic 8-seat sushi restaurant in Upper East Side called Sushi Nozu in March, and with Chef Nozu Mabe, whose nickname is Nozu. Sushi had become a part of American diet, and now we see more authentic sushi restaurants, particularly in New York City. So today we'll discuss what the authentic sushi culture is and how two young Americans open a classic sushi restaurant and Chef Noh's unique style of sushi and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher and on Spotify as well as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And we are running a summer membership drive right now, so please go to heritageradionetwork.org website and become a member. Thank you so much. So now let's start a conversation with the team Sushi Nozu. Hello, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So... I have so many questions. First of all, David and Josh, so what's your background? So first, where did you go? Did you grow up? And what did you eat when you grew up?
So Josh and I were born on the Upper East Side, just a few blocks away from the restaurant. Mm. So we grew up in Manhattan our whole life. Josh has lived here his whole life, and I moved to Miami 10 years ago. Mm. But we grew up, our parents were immigrants from Europe and from Iran, the Middle East. My mom came from Iran, then to Switzerland, and from Switzerland to America. And my dad came from France to America in 1979.
Mm. So sounds like an interesting mixture of delicious cuisine.
Very much so.
Wow.
So yeah, a lot of good, delicious French food, a lot of incredible Middle Eastern food. The Iranian cuisine ended up having such a big influence on both of us that even David ended up opening up a sort of Middle Eastern style restaurant in Florida that is very, very, very much influenced by what my mom and my grandma would make for us as kids. But we also ate a lot of takeout, a lot of sushi takeout and a lot of Chinese takeout and a lot of pizza and hot dogs and all the things, you know, you sort of associate with growing up in New York. So it's a, it was a very diverse amount of cuisine that we were exposed to. Some good, some great, some not so good.
Right.
Yeah.
So out of all those options, so David, you decided to study sushi in Tokyo. So how did it happen?
I was I was always a sushi fanatic, eating a lot of sushi from when I could remember, pretty much maybe 11, 10 years old, ordering sushi rolls and things like that. And then when I started being a little older, I learned about omakase.
Mm.
And I started, like most people, with you know, sushi seki, sushi yasuda, when I was young, and they got me and they taught me about the concept of sitting at a counter and having one piece of sushi at a time, and I thought it was very interesting and unique, and it was cool to see, you know, sushi done in a way that was not, like you said, in a box at a supermarket or in a roll with, you know, avocado and all these things in it. So I was studying hospitality in university, and then when I graduated, I wanted to learn how to cook more. Mm. And I spent some time learning in Barcelona how to cook and how to use a knife and how to break down fish. So I decided one day, I want to keep learning how to break down fish. I want to learn my knife skills, and I want to see Asia. And I had never been in my life. So I told my dad, I said, "Dad, what do you think?" He said, "Listen, if you find a reason to go, you should 100% go."
Mm.
So I found this... this very cool sushi academy, which was called the Tokyo Sushi Academy in Shinjuku.
Right.
And they do these 8-week courses where you have like a group of 30, 40 people, half Japanese, half international students.
Mm. Wow. So the idea of sushi school, as far as I know, like my dad would be angry to hear it.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, you have to learn.
Yeah.
Sushi by watching
100%.
And suffering, like probably Abe-san knows did.
Yeah.
Right. So, but do you think that was a good learning?
When I went, I didn't go with the intention of becoming a sushi chef.
Mm.
You know, I went with the intention of learning more about sushi and learning more about Japanese culture and hopefully meeting people that would be able to one day help me out.
Mm.
And it was thanks to that trip and that idea that I was able to learn about Japanese cuisine and Japanese culture. So very, very.
And let's not forget, that's also the trip that was the spark that started this whole project with Naz. It was through a friend that we met there, who later introduced us to Naz. I visited David when he was in. It was a perfect excuse for me to visit Asia for the first time.
Yeah, because you are the Joshi wanted to be. Musician, artist, or something like
that? No, so yeah, so I was working in the arts, in the field of arts, not as an artist, but with artists in a sort of management position with galleries and dealers and things like that, with absolutely no intention of joining the restaurant business.
Mm.
And so when David was in Tokyo at the Sushi Academy, the second he sort of applied, I started looking for flights. I was like, okay, how are we going to do this? How am I going to get to Tokyo? And so I spent a week with him there, and I have to say that that week is a week I'll never forget, because David was still in school, and he was working arduous hours. I mean, they had them working, these students working really hard. It wasn't a holiday. And so I ended up spending the majority of every day alone in Tokyo.
Mm.
And there's something incredibly romantic about being alone in Tokyo.
Mm.
In a place that's so foreign from anything you know, where you clearly do not belong, and just trying to make your way through it. And that was the first sort of sense of wanting to be involved with Japanese culture that ever occurred to me.
Huh.
I mean, even like David said, when he was at the Tokyo, like the Sushi Academy, it wasn't because we were hoping to open a sushi restaurant one day. I mean,
so,
that wasn't in the cards at all.
Well, but you immersed yourself into Japanese culture, like... You like dipped yourself, not
oh,
like
completely.
Slowly, right?
Yeah, so. And like David said, like for him, he was. I mean, David has always, since he was 10 years old, would analyze a menu at a restaurant like a chef would. But for me, the interest in Japanese culture actually wasn't derived necessarily from the food. I had a really good friend, a Japanese friend, growing up, Takefume, who introduced me to a lot of animated culture, anime culture, and definitely the Japanese art was super interesting to me in college. Like I said, I was studying art in college. So I actually approached an interest in the Japanese sensibilities, not necessarily from a culinary perspective.
Mm.
And so it was when we went to Japan, and when I went to Japan to visit David, and I was looking for places for us to eat, that I realized there's something really special going on, you know, in the Japanese kitchen.
Mm. What was the essence of it?
Josh, actually, when he came, Josh is very diligent. He's good at organizing things. I remember he made an Excel spreadsheet. It's funny because I told the story earlier and I thought I only remembered it today with the 15 sushi restaurants that we wanted to go to in Tokyo. He had done the research on Table Log and found, you know, the 15 best. And he said, David, this is the list. I said, yeah. Okay, so he gave the list to the concierge, and the concierge ended up...
We were able to get a few, not the ones that, like, people are booking 2 years in advance, but we ended up having some pretty amazing cuisine. And to answer your question, something that I later learned actually a lot from our partner, Naz, this idea of the shokunin, of mm-hmm. somebody who, when they look at food or they look at their craft... There's a look in their eyes that you see only in the most dedicated of people, and it's something that is inspiring. And we'll talk about this when we talk about Sushi Naz a little bit more. But guests who come to Naz, it's not just about experiencing great food, but it's about experiencing someone being able to watch somebody who's just so inspired and dedicated and doing what they love. And you know, when you're used to in New York, when you go to a restaurant in New York, if you dare to step foot in the kitchen, it's like the circus, right? And I mean, there's a whole beauty to that as well, but it's an entirely different experience. And that struck a chord immediately. And I'm sure we'll talk about this later as well, but the carpenters who built our restaurant then took that to a whole other level for me.
Mm.
I mean, I watched three carpenters delay 2 days of work to get one piece of joinery in just right. And that's something that really inspired me about Naz so early on and about Japanese culture in general. Mm. And that's what grabbed me really quickly when we were in Tokyo.
Sounds like the craftsmanship. You know, the Japanese people like tradition, and I think goes along with this word ikigai, the value of life.
Exactly.
Right? So that's the meaning of life. And all those craftsmen have that meaning in what they do.
Mm.
Right,
so. And by the way, it should be mentioned that this was a time where David and I were looking for meaning in our lives. You know, David was just out of college, a year or two out of school, and I was very much still in school and very unsure of what the future was holding for me.
Mm.
So that... It was a time we were both asking ourselves a lot of questions, and I don't know if we got answers, but it definitely had definitely kept us thinking.
Mm, right, yeah. But I think it's also the Japanese mind. There's no end.
Have to keep pursuing. Of course, there's so, no end.
Right, so I think you are in the right track in your ikigai search. Right. So now, craftsman Nozu-san. So I heard you've been in making sushi for the last 18 years. So where did you grow up, and why did you decide to become a sushi chef in the first place?
Okay, so I was born and grew up in Hokkaido, so which is the northern part of the Japan. So my hometown is so tiny. There's a fisherman areas. My grandfather also has a seafood company.
Mm.
So he always teach me how to use a knife, how to sharpen the knife.
Wow.
So how to preserve the fish, how to boil the crab, how to break the shell of the sea urchin, open the crab, open the scallop. Yeah, he teach me so many about the seafood. So I was, I wanted to be something like craftsman.
Mm.
Yeah, when I was a kid. Yeah.
Right, and also Hokkaido is really the treasure box of seafood.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? It's like unique. It's slightly different from other parts of Japan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they say the bays in Hokkaido, there's some magic in the water.
Right. Yeah. So, and the cold temperature and everything.
The cold temperature.
Yeah. Right. So, anyway, so where did you study sushi, Nozu-san?
I still study in sushi. Of course,
that's
yeah.
The right answer.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, first basic, I learned that sushi in my hometown in Sapporo City. Mm. And when I was 17, so I moved to the Sapporo City. So when I was 20, and then I moved to the Tokyo, and then I came in New York. When I was 24. So I learned about sushi in three locations.
So you decided to come to New York City, and why did you come to New York?
I'm so embarrassed. So when I was a high school student, so I was into skateboarding, hip-hop music, and fashion, so that made me want to live, especially in the New York City. Yeah.
Right, so it's interesting, right? And then you started working for Sushiden, which is one of the most established, popular sushi restaurants in New York City. So, and then you became an executive chef. So that's very impressive. So let's go back to David Josh. Why did you open a sushi restaurant in New York City?
So, like I said earlier, David and I don't think we ever had the intention of doing it. And it wasn't until we met Naz and we tried his food at Sushiden. And for the listeners who don't know about Sushiden, it's a fantastic restaurant that is not necessarily known for its fine dining. It's popular among a corporate crowd, especially for lunch. It's in Midtown of Manhattan. And so when we went for the first time after we met Naz to try his cuisine, we were expecting just that, a corporate lunch. We thought we were going to be spending $30 or $40, get some buri and maybe some tempura. And what ended up happening, in fact, was that we were provided with an experience very similar to what we're now offering at Sushi Naz. It was a 2.5 hour, 25-course meal that Naz had prepared for us. And David and I sort of looked at each other at the end of this meal, and we recognized that there was something going on with Naz and that we wanted to be a part of it. I imagine that he could have just as easily have been a musician or an actor. And we just heard his song on the radio, or not on the radio, you know, we just heard him sing a song, and we said to ourselves, man, we want to be involved. You know, wow. It could have just as easily have been that.
I wish we had some recording today to play. I wish I knew.
No. I'm saying he could have been if he was a musician.
Okay.
It turns out he was a sushi chef. Yeah. And it turned out that we wanted to be a part of it more than anything.
But you knew him. How did you find him?
So we came in contact with some chefs in Tokyo who we had a sort of like a late night out with in Tokyo. And that chef was coming to New York. So this was in June or July. And he had a trip planned in September. And we got a phone call in September saying, I'm in town, do you guys want to get together? And we said, sure. So we went to a hotel in Chelsea called the Americana Hotel. And I'll never forget it because it's the first time.
4 years ago, right?
Yeah, 4 years ago. And the chef didn't speak great English. And so he brought along Naz sort of as a friend, but also as sort of a translator. And it was a funny crowd because that chef was much older than Naz and myself. I was 21 at the time. Naz was 27, 28, 29, 28, 29. And I had brought along one of my friends who was also much older than us. So it sort of worked out that the two of them were talking a lot and Naz and I were talking a lot. And we instantly connected. And that's when he told me he worked at Sushiden. And he was like, oh, you should stop by for lunch next week. And, you know, the rest is history.
Wow. Yeah. So it's a coincidence, but sounds like a destiny too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So, before the show, it's kind of like a jump to the next step, but your restaurant, Nozu, is running so well, even in the summertime. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Right. But when you opened together, three of you together, what is the biggest challenge in opening a sushi restaurant?
Oh my God. Well, so Naz just mentioned that we met 4 years ago and we shook hands on this almost 4 years ago, very quickly after that. So this was a long, long process, and it's hard looking back to pick out what was the hardest part. But the first thing I think about when you say that is the logistics of having it built in Japan and having it shipped over here. We had the crazy idea to have Sukiya Daiku, like tea room architects, carpenters mm-hmm. from Japan, actually build our restaurant in Kyoto.
That's ridiculous. Yeah, it, I would not be able to even imagine doing
it. Yeah, it really was ridiculous. And it was as close to being impossible without being impossible.
Right.
And so just the pure logistics of shipping over all of that material. I think we shipped over 1,000 pieces of wood, stone, and sand to New York. That was a challenge. I think at one point we thought maybe we wouldn't be able to overcome it.
Mm.
And we were.
Right, but whose idea was that?
I have a mentor who's been sort of my guiding force in all things Japanese for a long time. Actually, my childhood friend that I told you about earlier, it's his father, Koichi Yanagi, who actually has a wonderful art gallery in Manhattan, a great Japanese art gallery. And when I had run the idea by him of opening a Japanese restaurant, he set out some rules for me.
Mm.
And one of the rules that he told me was that if you're going to do this, you're going to do it right. And so he introduced me to the carpenters who built his gallery. And I went to visit them. They were in Chiba. Is that right? No, it's
Shiga.
Shiga, excuse me. In Shiga. And it took me a minute after stepping into their warehouse, into their carpentry studio, for me to realize that this was the only way I was going to build a restaurant, was if they were going to do it.
Mm.
And so that's how it happened.
Right. And your artist background, which studied knowledge of art, may have pushed you towards that direction as well.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, the most important thing for David and I when we built this restaurant was we knew that Naz's cuisine was so special.
Mm.
And we knew that there was a lot of sushi restaurants opening in New York. And we knew that it was something that if we didn't do something unique and real to ourselves, that it was just going to get lost in the, you know, in the crowd. And I knew that whatever we did, it had to live up to the quality of Naz's personality and Naz's skill.
Mm.
So it wasn't going to be enough to just build a restaurant. Mm. It had to be something that was as important as what he was doing.
Right. Interesting, because I personally, when I saw your restaurant, this is something else, because you really feel the weight of tradition and all those details. But it's interesting that your childhood friend's father had that kind of connection too.
Yeah.
So sounds like everything's based on destiny.
Yeah. Yanagi-san, if you're listening, thank you very much.
Right. Okay, so let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss Nozu-san's unique style of sushi. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I've been with the station for over 8 years, 350 shows, and it is the most consistent thing in my life. every Tuesday at 3. I know to be here in studio, but I also get the privilege of meeting such amazing people, artists, artisans within the industry. Get to learn a new factoid, a new way of life from these wonderful people. And I hope you do too by listening and that you donate to our summer drive. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and click on the beating heart. And we'd even appreciate monthly recurring donations to any show on the network you could designate to the food scene, the speakeasy, and that many more.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from the studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guests today are David and Joshua Fuke, the two brothers who opened an authentic 8-seat sushi restaurant in Upper East Side called the Sushi Nozu in March this year, with Chef Nozomu Abe, whose nickname is Nozu. So, I don't know who can answer this question, but you serve edomae sushi at the Sushi Nozu. So, for listeners who are not familiar with the term, what is edomae sushi?
Edomae is like most oldest sushi style in Japan. Like fish, everything cooked, preserved, no raw, like Asian. Yeah, it's most oldest style.
Mm. And the Edo means Tokyo. So the fish basically was developed in area, in Tokyo area.
Yeah, well, this is like a funny conversation you'll always hear around sushi counter. A big argument about what does it really mean to be an edomae style sushi restaurant. And everybody has a sort of different idea. And the truth is, for a restaurant to be 100% pure edomae, they would, like you just mentioned, have to, in fact, only be using fish from Tokyo Bay. Mm. And I'm not even sure that there's a sushi restaurant left in Tokyo that only uses fish from Tokyo Bay. So in that sense, to be truly edomae is maybe more so a philosophy than anything else.
Mm.
And I won't be the one who goes on the air and tries to give a definitive answer of what it means.
Right.
What I will tell you is that although we are proudly calling ourselves an edomae-style restaurant, Naz is not afraid to use sort of Western techniques that he's picked up over the years, and Western ingredients, and French dishes. We've accidentally turned one of our signature dishes into a French fusion dish. Naz has started serving Akaza Ebi, langoustines, Scottish langoustines on the menu, and our restaurant has very little waste, and we were finding that we couldn't use the shells from the langoustines for anything, and Naz had the idea to reduce them and turn them into a bouillabaisse. And so now we quite often will finish off the otsumami portion of the omakase with a sort of a bouillabaisse, which I reckon you would never find in a true edamame style restaurant. So,
right. Yeah. So, So the idea of edamame in the modern sense, in my opinion, as far as you have the best ingredients from local, what's available. So it can be edamame. It's not like Long Island edamame or something.
Yeah.
Like that. that's the idea of the best ingredients available. Because it was when edamame was developed, there's no refrigeration.
Yes.
So you have to have the best freshest fish
exactly.
from the bay. So I think that's the same idea.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think I remember that when I had the dinner, there is a not the bouillabaisse, but the same Scottish shrimp for the prawn, and so Nodson said, well, he only gets the frozen version of seafood, which is possible because otherwise you're eating dead flavor.
Yes.
And also because Scottish one doesn't come in the sawdust, which leaves the flavor on the meat. That was, this is a craftsmanship we're talking about. So I was very impressed. So, okay, so what kind of menu do you offer at Sushi Nozu?
So, I always decide a menu. I'm thinking of a season. So for example, summertime, people need something freshness, like acid and cold dish. So winter, people need something warm, hot, you know, oily dish. So, so I was thinking about the season. Also, I always check the quality of the fish on the day.
Right.
And then, yeah, and then I decide the menu.
Mm. So when I was there, there are like five, six appetizers, various, including the kind of like a bouillabaisse, the Western style flavor, and followed by 12 to 15 sushi, but the nigiri sushi. So so it changes every day?
Yes. It doesn't only change every day. It actually even changes between our two seatings sometimes.
Oh, my God.
The 6 p.m. will very often have one or two different appetizers and one or two different nigiri than the 9 p.m. seating. I've never asked Naz why, but that's not my job to ask.
Why is that? Let's just make it why.
It's to make my life more difficult with the menus. And I think it's important to mention also because especially Westerners and New Yorkers, our ideas of seasonality are very different. We think of seasons as just summer, spring, fall, and winter. When in reality, maybe more so for a sushi chef than anyone else, there's micro-seasonality.
Mm.
You know, there are seasons that can be broken down into 2 or 3 weeks.
Right.
There's ingredients that, you know, Naz is looking forward to using between June 1st and June 21st that, you know, July 1st won't be available anymore.
Right.
So we've never, I think I can say we have never served the same menu twice. And every day is a surprise for us, just as much as it is for the customer.
Mm, that's amazing. And you can get to taste.
You know what? I get that question a lot. And David and I, I've eaten at the restaurant now 3 times, and David has eaten there 3 times as well. So I wish I was eating, I was tasting every day, but...
Yeah. Well, that means that you are good management.
Yeah. No, I tell, when my customers ask that, I tell them, I get more joy out of watching others enjoy it than I imagine I would out of myself enjoying it.
Right. Okay. And so, by the way, Nozu-san, your sushi is authentic, but you incorporate new elements in addition to that bouillabaisse, that kind of idea. But maybe you can give us some more examples of your originality.
I try to find something like new style. Mm. Yeah, but I don't want to make something fusion dish. So I want to keep traditional Edamame style, but we always try to find something new ingredients. So, for example, one of our signature dish, octopus with hummus puree. Mm. So usually octopus stewed with the red beans.
Mm.
It's a common Japanese food, but I can't find Japanese red beans in the New York. So that's why I find chickpea instead of the red beans.
I really enjoyed the creaminess. That was a new discovery. Mm-hmm. That makes sense, totally. Yeah.
So we always something, our new North style.
Hi, and it never repeats. Always new. Hi. Okay. So I heard that you use the fresh rice for your sushi instead of a standard, somewhat aged rice. So why do you do that?
So mostly sushi chef using komai, which is a dry rice, but we using the shinmai, which is a fresh rice. So shinmai is a very moist, a lot of sweeter more than komai. So however, after mixing the vinegar rice, shinmai will be a little bit sticky. Sticky, so it has to be harder to make good sushi. But our rice form is making good shinmai for sushi chef. So he's thinking, what is the best rice? How to keep good quality after mixing the vinegar, even the shinmai. So that's why I use his rice.
So he developed a new kind of species.
Yeah.
Right.
Josh and I went to his former place, so we know how do they make a rice. So we know they are so much passionate.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow. Okay. And so also, Nozu-san, so the... There's a behind the counter, there's a interesting freezer. And it's like beautiful, not just beautiful, but it's
a refrigerator.
Interesting.
Yeah,
a refrigerator. Okay. Yeah. So how do you describe? What is it and how does it work?
Okay, so regular refrigerator is too cold for the fish. But our ice chest is not electronic. We use big ice cube on the top of the ice chest. And cool air coming from ice. It's softer than regular refrigerator. Mm. Also can keep fish moist in.
Right.
Yeah. So refrigerators tend to dry out fish a lot.
Because of the air coming in.
Exactly.
Right.
Dry out everything.
Dry out everything.
It's the best way to maintain the fish.
Wow. But it's not usually available, right?
Oh, no, no. Yeah. I mean, it was, we weren't even sure if we could get one. It was a craftsman in Tokyo who makes very few of them a year. And he's really picky about who he works with. And actually, usually he has to try the Itamai's sushi before agreeing to work with them. And through some miracle of God, I got his contact information and sent it to Naz and had Naz handwrite him a letter asking him if, explain to him our concept and what we were trying to do to New York and asking him if he wanted to be a part of it. And so we organized a trip around, we went to Tokyo with a lot of other purposes in mind, but really with the big idea of it, having him agree making us one of these ice chests. And he obliged, and we were able to do it, and we were very thankful that he agreed to do it. And, right. And we patiently await him to come to the restaurant.
Well, I cannot imagine, I don't know how many, that's called the Himuro,
exactly.
Right, producers exist in Japan either.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Maybe only us in the United States.
I think, you know,
sushi show.
I have to go on the record as saying there's a one in Hawaii. There is one in Hawaii, and I've noticed some people on the Sushi Naz Instagram have made a point to point that out to us.
So call it the continental United States.
It's the continental United States. Right. I really didn't know, by the way, until after someone had mentioned it. But.
Right. Just one in the East Coast, that should be enough, even.
Right. On the mainland.
Yeah. Right. And, okay, so you have only two seatings per night, 6 and 9, right? So what's the point of serving a group of customers together at the same time?
Oh, there's a very practical answer to that. You know, David and I and Naz, we had a huge decision to make when we started the restaurant, was how many seats are we going to put at the counter? And frequently in New York, you'll see more than 10 seats. And as soon as you surpass a certain number, it's very difficult to maintain a certain quality. At the very least, it's very hard for one chef to take care of that many people. You can certainly maintain a high standard of quality, but it was very important to us that Naz was the one taking care of everybody. And we, through experimentation, through catering, and obviously through his 18 years of experience, were able to deduce that 8 was the magic number. And the way Naz courses out his otsumami and the way he does his nigiri and how everything is prepared very much in a specific way, it would be almost impossible for Naz to serve people in a scattered arrangement. You know, if two people showed up at 6 and 2 at 7:30 and 4 at 8, he would not be able to sort of perform the show at such a consistently high level as he has been.
Yeah, so when I dined there, I really enjoyed, you know, because he was able to focus on what he does at the same time. It's like a show, and the customers can see. And also his attention is 100% on what he's doing. And also at the end of the dinner, there's a communal sense, the sharing, admiring what it was. So yeah, I thought it was really a great idea. So, but the menu price is $300, including gratuity, which is great. But, you know, and I think people might think it's super expensive. And there are expensive sushi restaurants, but I thought it was valuable. So what value do you think, in your opinion, offering for $300?
Yeah. So we set out to transport people. We're more so in the transportation business than we are in any other business. And I say that because really the goal at Sushi Naz is for you to forget that you're in New York City and that you had a long work day, and for you, for just a few hours, experience something absolutely new and unique and peaceful that happens to include a really good food. And this idea of it being a show almost a theatrical performance is something that brings a lot of value to it. I don't want people to, you know, weigh the food and say, I just paid $300 and got this much food. I want people to learn about Japan. I want people to visit Japan. I want people to see what I saw in Nas the first time I saw him work, that sense of passion, and I want people to be inspired. You know, we have 40 feet of storefront in the restaurant, which is crazy in New York. It's a lot of storefront. Mm-hmm. Most people would have floor-to-ceiling windows and outdoor seating, and we have just a big white wall. Mm-hmm. And it's really because I want you to lose your sense of where you are for a couple hours. And I think that's a big part of where the value is, not to mention the quality of the food is, as far as I'm concerned, as exceptional as you'll find anywhere else in the United States.
Right. And there's a conversation too, that little thing, like, you know, the prawn in the sawdust or not, that kind of thing. We're educated. I learned so much after the dinner, that kind of thing too. So, but so the transportation, of course, includes the amazing decor we mentioned already. But maybe you can tell us the concept, design concept, and some details.
Yeah, so the roots of the design are in what's referred to as Sukiya style architecture, which is a tea room style of architecture that was very popular in the Edo period. And Sukiya style architecture is, it's almost like a religious architecture in that it follows a very specific tenet of rules, a lot like you might find in Western religious architecture. You know, I'm not saying it looks anything like Gothic architecture, but there's sort of, when you're building, you know, when these architects were building these churches in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, they were following hundreds of years of tradition of how things were done. And in Sukiya style architecture, you find a lot of that sort of historical preserving a sense of history in the style. And sort of the big, most important components of it are the fact that it only uses natural elements. So you only find sand, stone, and wood. That very specific woods can be placed in very specific places. Balances in light. Finding harmony and imbalances. So, for example, our counter, behind the counter, are these two big, beautiful pillars of cedar wood that are completely asymmetrical. And sort of finding harmony in that asymmetry is something that's very important in Sukiya-style architecture and in Japanese aesthetics in general. And so you're confronted with a lot of paradox in Sukiya-style architecture. And so, yeah, that's sort of the root of the design. And like we mentioned earlier, the restaurant was actually built in Japan. So you're face-to-face, you're touching wood that not so long ago was, you know, more than 5,000 miles away. And it's all very textural. There's different textures everywhere. And we encourage people to touch everything and to feel it with their hands. And there's a presence of the artist and the carpenters that you don't necessarily find in Western-style architecture.
Right. Yeah, it's such a tranquility.
Yeah, really a sense of nature and balance and harmony that is... It's very unique.
Right. I was thinking, like, you know, it's like a whole Brooklyn thing's going. There's a nice old warehouse factory style. And you can transport to somewhere else.
Oh, yeah.
And then, but somehow you managed to build the real Sukiya in the middle of New York City. And I really enjoyed being there.
Thank you.
And also the serving vessels, you have the same level of attention, right?
Yeah, well, one of the first questions you asked about what were the hardest parts, actually, my mind also jumped to that. I mean, we spent almost 4 years traveling around Japan finding the right vessels. And we have vessels that represent, you know, five different centuries of Japanese ceramics that range from every different style under the sun. And that's something that we're all very, very, very proud of.
Right. And what I really enjoyed was, usually if you go to Kyoto or those places and you see it, put it in your hand, oh, I wish I could own it. But you eat something right on it. So that was a precious experience, I think. Yeah. But who come to your restaurant? Who are your customers?
We have everybody, every different type of person comes to our restaurant. I think that the biggest surprise to us is that opening on the Upper East Side, I think we all sort of expected a predominantly Upper East Side clientele.
Mm.
But we have people coming from all around the world. I mean, from downtown to Hong Kong to France and Spain and Argentina. And we've had people from...
That's, you know, at the beginning I said there are more expensive sushi restaurants in New York City especially, but I really think there's a maturity of customers' perception about sushi, right? So that's your place is the proof of it. So how do you predict the future of sushi in the States?
Future of sushi in the States, wow.
Or anywhere, globally.
Well, sushi in the States has changed a lot in the last 10 years. Obviously from 40 years ago when the first sushi house came to New York. But now I think when we first opened, Josh was concerned that there would be other people serving our style of sushi and that it would make the mystique of our edamai style sushi or our take on edamai style sushi for some reason...
Less interesting.
But I think it's the opposite. I think what you need is you need people to educate, like you just said, mature, grow up, grow out of a maki, a California roll, to a piece of nigiri, to then a piece of, you know, sashimi. And then once you've had the whole entry level, you start trying omakase, and then you start seeing the different ways. And I think that New York is obviously the forefront of all cuisine, probably in the world. So I think that from New York, outside of Japan, I think everything will spread. So I think the more edamai style, traditionally legitimate restaurants that open here, you'll start seeing some in Los Angeles, you'll start probably seeing some in San Francisco, hopefully maybe Sushi Naz one day.
Yeah, so I have to say, David, throughout this whole process, was sort of like our... he was the cornerstone of hope and faith through it all. Because in the 4 years that we tried to open this, a lot of things almost went really bad, really wrong. And David was, and I had a lot of doubt, you know, again, like David mentioned, I had a lot of doubt about if this was too traditional for New Yorkers, if this was, especially with, you know, there is an emphasis on aging, but it's not what defines us. And I was worried that people were going to be scared of that. And David was always the one to tell me, like, if... it's as good as we know Naz it is, and people keep educating themselves, and more restaurants like this open up, it's only going to become more interesting to people. And I have to say, now, you know, when you ask about the future of sushi, especially in New York, the future is going towards this more traditional style. There was a 5-year period where the sort of New York style omakase was booming. And in the last year alone, we've had, you know, Shoji, Uchu,
Onodera,
Amane, are four restaurants that are absolutely Tokyo style. I mean, you know, as much as you can be in New York, Tokyo style restaurants. And you look at the 2 years before that, and it was, you know, like that downtown style. And so it's great. I think that's going to drive a lot of interest for people going to Japan. I think a lot more people now are going to Japan than were going 5 years ago. And then they come back and they're looking for that.
Right.
You know.
So I think a while ago, the Japanese government had a discussion that worried about Japanese sushi restaurants not owned or understood by even the owners. So that kind of thing. It's great. Sushi is popular, but... where is the culture being communicated properly? So I really like the Naz because this is so right. I'm learning so much from this dining experience, a couple hours.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I have to say some of the more rewarding moments are when our Japanese customers who live in Japan come to the restaurant. And I'm not sure what their expectations were, but I think that they are so happy to see that what we're doing is... that we're doing what we're doing, and that's really rewarding for, I know that's really rewarding for Naz and I, when we're able to, you know, show somebody who it doesn't live in New York that, listen, we can do it right here also. Like, we're showing people, you know, how it can be done in New York.
Right. Yeah.
Nowadays, people, you know, being a global city, people from all over are going to come and eat sushi in New York. Just doesn't mean that we can't be the best sushi restaurant in the world being in New York. They say the best pizza restaurant is in Tokyo. So if a guy can open the best pizzeria in the world in Tokyo, we can open the best sushi restaurant in the world in New York. And that's what we're trying to do.
Right. I think it's a focus. Like, for instance, I went to one of those sushi restaurants in Japan, and it was, I heard sushi restaurants make money fairly well in Japan too, but there's no focus. Like, you can feel it's a business.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it's not the craftsmanship. So it doesn't matter where you are. It's just craftsmanship.
Exactly.
It's at Nozu. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So what are you guys planning?
Oh, we just want this to get better every day. Right now we're planning for tonight's service.
Yeah.
Right. Tomorrow we're going to plan for tomorrow's service.
I won't keep the quality.
Yeah. Right. Well, it must be hard to rebuild another set of all the skier room in another place.
The good thing now is we know what to do, more or less. We have an idea. We don't know exactly, but
you can see it.
The most important thing is to take your time. You know, Danny Meyer is obviously very important for a lot of people in this business, and if you read his book, he was great and he built an amazing empire. But it was one step at a time. You know, opened one restaurant, made sure that it was great and that it was an institution, and then he developed. So hopefully, you know, with Nas, at least with me, it was like that. Three years I spent in one restaurant, and now I. 3 years is another one. Hopefully, maybe in 3 years there'll be another one. But definitely, we don't need to rush and hopefully become, like I said, the best restaurant that we can be.
Well, I think it's going to happen. So, good luck.
Thank you.
So, thank you for joining us today. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneseheritageradionetwork.org or hikuatemako.com. Oh, before I forget, how the listeners can get to know the details of Nozu and an update?
Oh, well, you can follow us on social media. We have an Instagram account at SushiNazNYC. We're posting really wonderful photos and we try to explain a lot of what Naz's process is like and all about our ceramics and the design of the restaurant through that medium. And then we just launched our full website as well, which does a fantastic job of answering all the questions you would have about Sushi Naz, about Naz himself. And so I would start there.
Great. All right. So again, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll keep us posted.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so the Japanese is live on 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And the engineer today is David Tadashor, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.